Morning. We're covering chapters 30 and 31 of Isaiah this morning, so if you can turn there, and we'll dive into that, looking at these chapters that are messages from Isaiah before the Assyrians lay siege to Jerusalem. Not everything has to do with that threat of Assyria, but that is the general backdrop to these sermons he's preaching in these first 35 chapters, so that's what we're going to look at this morning. Dave, could you lead us in a prayer as we start, please?
Our Father and gracious God, we're so thankful for all your many blessings and for the rest through the night that you've allowed us to come to this place to study your word and to learn more about you and your precepts and laws and what is expected of us. Please forgive us of our sins and help us to live upright before you. Help us through this class to learn all that we can to please you. In Jesus' name, amen.
So there is a perpetual human problem that is found in the immediate situation that Isaiah is addressing in chapters 30 and 31. And that perpetual human problem is our tendency to lean on other sources of strength rather than the Lord. I mean, that is a very fundamental lesson. Don't lean on yourself. Don't lean on the physical. Don't lean on others. Lean on the Lord. And that's exactly the message of Isaiah 30 and 31. And it was really a serious error that people were making in the days of Isaiah. It was a serious error. However, by the Lord's mercy, it was not a fatal error. In a couple of generations later, in the days of Jeremiah, because Jeremiah is going to come along nearly a century later, in the days of Jeremiah, they will tend to do the same thing, and it will be a fatal error. So, chapter 30, nothing like starting a class with a sober note like that, okay? A fatal error. But such are the writings of the prophets, right? So look here at Isaiah 30. Let's start here in verses 1 through 5. Rick, can you read that for us? 1 through 5.
Woe to the rebellious children, declares the Lord, who execute a plan but not mine, and make an alliance but not of my spirit, in order to add sin to sin, who proceed down to Egypt without consulting me, to take refuge in the safety of Pharaoh, and to seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore, the safety of Pharaoh will be your shame, and the shelter in the shadow of Egypt your humiliation. For their princes are at Zion, and their ambassadors arrive at Hanes. Everyone will be ashamed because of people who cannot profit them, who are not for help or profit, but for shame and also for reproach.
So thank you. Again, the general backdrop of chapters 1 through 35 is that of the Assyrian Empire being so mighty and penetrating down into this area where Israel and Judah are, and it will lead to the fall of Israel and the damage to Judah that Assyria will do. And this chapter here, this message right here, and the one in the next chapter are directly related to that Assyrian threat. Well, in light of the Assyrian threat, what were the people of Judah doing? What?
Relying on Egypt.
Relying on Egypt. They thought Egypt could be their savior. And this is what they're doing. But look how God starts this message off through Isaiah's lips. He calls these people of Judah stubborn or rebellious children. Stubborn or rebellious children. Now, what was the problem with the plan? He says, you have a plan. It's good to have a plan, right? What's the problem with their plan? It's not God's plan. It's one they came up with. And that they have an alliance. Hey, it's good to work on a team, right? It's always good to have a friend or a buddy. What's the problem with this alliance? It is empty and futile. It's not going to save them. And it's like his plan. He says, it's not of my spirit. This is not what I want. And since it's not what God wants, it's not going to work, is it? It's going to be futile. And according to what is said here, you know, especially verse 2, how are they planning to view Egypt? They thought Egypt would be their what? Their safety, their shelter, their protection. How many times do we see in the Psalms references to God being shelter, refuge, protection, even the idea of wall around us and things such as that? And look at verse 4. What had they done in conjunction with this plan and this planned alliance? According to verse 4, they had done what? What had they sent?
They sent
ambassadors. That's right. Ambassadors, diplomats, envoys down to Egypt to build this alliance. Okay. And according to verse 5, and this is what Frank was driving at just a moment ago, according to verse 5, what would be the outcome of this plan that Judah had to lean on Egypt? It would result in what?
Nothing.
Nothing. Their shame. Can't profit them. Exactly. Now, from a human standpoint, this makes perfect sense because of the balance of power here in what we call today the Middle East. So, I mean, this goes back not just years, not just decades, not just centuries. This nearly goes back millennia. And that is, you had some power in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, what the Greeks later called Mesopotamia, land between the rivers. And you have Egypt, which is the power of the Nile River Valley. And these two areas were prosperous, populated. They had strong governments. They had strong militaries. And when we come to the days of Isaiah, it's Assyria up here that is the dominant force in Mesopotamia. And they have extended themselves down into Judah and to Israel. And on the other side is Egypt. And for all these many years, there's been this counterbalance between Egypt and a Tigris-Euphrates River power. Especially you're getting into this middle and latter part of the Old Testament. You see that during the days of the kings. Now, Egypt is still a power. It's not a power like it was, but it is still substantial power and will be for a little while longer. And so it made perfect sense for Judah to say, hey, Assyria is threatening us. Let's counterbalance them and get Egypt on our side. Let's buddy up with Egypt, and this will be a protection for us. They are thinking in a very physical, human, political, military, shrewd way. That's how you ought to think if you don't have God. Because if you don't have God, that's all you've got. But they had God. The very fact that they were in this land is because God had planted them in that land. And if God was not going to be their protector, then any protection was, well, as we've seen, to no avail. And I want you to think about the symbolism here that's occurring in the latter part of the Old Testament. They think the solution is in going to Egypt. They think the solution is in going, shall we say, back to Egypt. What's the irony?
They fled their slavery.
Right. They had once thought salvation was in Egypt, and it was from the famine through Joseph's intervention. But once they got there, they were enslaved, and they had been delivered from this evil power. And now they think their solution is to go back to Egypt. Now, this is centuries and centuries later, this is a completely different dynasty. However, it's an interesting symbolism here, how ironic this is. And watch when we get later on in the year and we start studying Jeremiah, which is more than two generations after Isaiah. And Jeremiah is alive when not the Assyrians, but the Babylonians take Jerusalem. That there was also a pro-Egyptian party. There's a pro-Egyptian faction in Judah and in Jerusalem, that again, they think that Egypt is the place to go. And even after Babylon's overrun them, they think Egypt is the place to go. And so watch this come up and how that is such an ironic picture of God's people going back to Egypt. Yeah, Joe?
It's only okay to go to Egypt if God sent them.
And he's not now. Right. Well, at one time, he used Egypt as a safe haven. He's not now. He's actually warning against it.
Jesus and his parents went there.
Yep. Right. Another symbolic thing, out of Egypt I called my son, just like he called Israel out of Egypt, he called the Messiah out of Egypt. But that's not the plan. Look what he says here. This is not of my plan. This is not of my spirit. So you're exactly right. That's the distinction. This is not God's safe haven at this point for them. Not at all.
So in Deuteronomy 17 and verse 16, moreover, speaking to the kings, moreover, he shall not have multiply horses for himself, or shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses? Said the Lord, you shall never again return that way. Now, not that they were ever going to migrate back to Egypt and live there, and certainly live under slavery, but migrating back to Egypt metaphorically is your affections and your attentions should not be directed. Oh, that we only if we had the leeks and the onions that were back there, only if we had their military power, if we had their horses, if we had their military might and their help and whatever. And God is saying, you're done with them. I brought you out in your mind, and they are returning to Egypt here. They are doing exactly the thing that Moses taught in Deuteronomy not to do.
It's so interesting how that this is an Old Testament-wide motif or phenomenon. And that is, you've been delivered from Egypt. Don't go back. It's a very broad Old Testament thing going on.
Well, the dichotomy also here is that the Lord was more powerful than Egypt.
That's what he's going to say.
So why would you rely upon the lesser of the two powers that brought you out by a mighty and strong hand?
And that's back to the thing that we started with, the point, and that is the human tendency to lean on other sources of strength apart from God. And we do it. And the good question is, why do we do that? Okay. Well, look what he says next in verse 6 and 7. Les, can you read those verses 6 and 7, please?
The burden against the beast of the south. Through a land of trouble and anguish, from one from which came the lioness and lion, the viper and the fiery flying serpent, they will carry their riches on the backs of young donkeys and their treasures on the humps of camels, to a people who shall not profit. For the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. Therefore, I have called her Rahab Himshebeth.
Okay, good job on the Hebrew. All right, so didn't know you were a native speaker. So what is this talking about? Well, this is talking about those envoys, those ambassadors back in verse 5 that had been sent to Egypt. Because what are they carrying in verse 6? Pardon? Payment. They're carrying riches. They're carrying gifts to the Egyptian officials, because if you're going to go to a strong power to get them to be your ally, you got to pay up.
Things never change.
Things never change. It's like a tribute. Although, I'm not going to go off on this, but in modern times, it's sort of the reverse. In 20th century, 21st century terms, it's the smaller power that ends up getting paid off if you let the big power come in and do something on your land or something, you know. You get benefits. But in ancient times, this was a tribute system in ancient times. And so everybody's paying up the big man. And so Egypt here is going to expect a gift if they're going to weigh in on this. Yeah, Andrew?
And it also goes to show just how desperate, but at the same time not desperate enough, these people are. Egypt hasn't been powerful throughout the whole time. They show up maybe twice in the whole set of the Kings and Chronicles. I mean, they've not been a big story for years.
They have it in Old Testament narrative. You're exactly right. It's easy for us, when they drop off in the Old Testament narrative, to conclude that they're irrelevant. They're far from irrelevant. They don't become irrelevant really until the Greeks. The Greeks, once Alexander mows over Egypt, Egypt is under somebody's boot heel. And first the Greeks, then it's the Romans. And after the Romans, they'll have an interlude, and then it'll be the Islamic forces. So, but at this time, they still have some wealth. They still have numbers. They still have a dynamic government organization. They still have some muscle. Are they what they were? No, but they have enough for Judah to be tempted to lean on them. And actually, Egypt holds itself fairly well against Babylon. They don't. Assyria comes in and invades Egypt and plunders them to some extent and take a lot of captives. They sort of hold their own against Babylon. It's the Persians who come in and really subdue the Egyptians. And once the Greeks come, they're done for as a power. They're not even a regional power after the Greeks, after Alexander. So, but there's the lesson. I mean, the point you're making, Andrew, therein is the lesson. If you lean on a human power, they're all destined to fail. Every one of them. And if any human civilization thinks, no, we're different. We're more advanced, more powerful, we're more wealthy than anybody. Go read about Rome. Go read about the Greeks. Go read about the Egyptians. And this is what the prophets are teaching over and over. You don't rely on these physical things.
Israel was told from the beginning not to have horses and worry about that kind of power.
Right. Lean on God. Exactly. Rick,
what did you say? Well, I was just going to say it's so humanistic that we think that humans can solve all the problems, no matter what they are.
Or what they are. Yeah. Yeah. Either science has the solution, human science has the solution, or the business world, the commercial world has the solution to all of our problems. Or the political realm, they have the solution to our problem. Or academia has our solution. Just get those PhDs researching something and they'll figure it out for us and we'll all be okay. That's the same thing as leaning on Egypt. It's exactly the same thing. So even though this is very contextual, this message here in 30 and 31, it's about Judah being tempted to lean on Egypt. It is so universal, isn't it? It's so universal. All right. And so those envoys, as they're making their way down to Egypt, they got an Amber Alert. So there we go.
God views them under Hezekiah's reign. Now behold, you rely on the staff of this crushed reed, even on Egypt. This is 2 Kings 18,
right.
Which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce him. So is Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to all who rely on him. So think of the picture is, you've got this reed you're leaning on, thinking that it's going to support you, but what does it do? It spears right through you and harms you. And that's his view of, to God, all the nations of men and their advances and innovations and power is just a crushed reed. It amounts to nothing. And we as his people have to learn to really rely upon the true power above rather than any sort of earthly power that appears to be able to help us out of our condition.
Right. And this is interesting what he says here in verse 7, and when he says, you know, this is worthless and empty, leaning on Egypt. He calls Egypt, what name? Your translations vary here, but there is one name that's in all of them.
Rahab.
Okay, now, it's not who you think it is. This is not a new application of a reference to the woman who guided the spies when they came to Jericho. The term Rahab actually means, the word actually means proud or strength. And literally what this expression is, and different translations render it differently. English Standard says Rahab who sits still. The New American says what? Rahab. The New American says what?
Who has been exterminated.
Rahab, who has been exterminated. Okay? Depends on which New American, I guess. I looked at one that was different. New King James says, oh, it's got the whole Hebrew term. Yeah. So,
well, arrogance is a footnote.
Okay. Right. So proud or strength is literally what the word Rahab means. And what this expression means in the original language is the big, powerful, strong one who does nothing. The boaster who sits still. That's one other translation of this expression. The boaster who says, I'm powerful, you can lean on me, who sits still, who does nothing. The big talker who does nothing. That's what this is saying. And so, well, what vivid language here Isaiah is using to say, Egypt is all talk, no do. Don't lean on them. All right, look at verses 8 through 11. Can you read that for us, Jesse, 8 through 11?
Now go, write it before them on a tablet, and note it on a scroll that it may be for time to come, forever and ever, that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children who will not hear the law of the Lord, who say to the seers, do not see, to the prophets, do not prophesy to us right things, speak to us smooth things, prophesy deceits. Get out of the way, turn aside from the path, cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us.
All right, thank you. verse 8 is sort of the theme verse we've used for this class. You may note it, you go back, you just see something all the time, you don't pay attention. I think that's a really good theme for looking at any prophetic work right there. Go write this on a tablet. And let's look at this in context. He's telling Isaiah's, and like these other prophets, are most likely speaking this message, but God also wants them to record it. And it's interesting why he wants them to record it in light of this context right here. What does he say back there? What does he say here about these people of Judah? You need to write this down. Why? Because they're so rebellious. Now let's dissect their rebellion here. In other words, there's going to be a written record of indictment against them. Why? Well, remember earlier he called them stubborn or rebellious children. He comes back in verse 9 and calls them rebellious again, rebellious people. And what are these people wanting? What are their requests?
Pleasant words.
They want pleasant words. They want prophets like Isaiah to what?
Be quiet.
Be quiet and get out of the way.
Tell them what they want to hear.
We want to hear a certain message. We don't want to hear what you have to say. Speak to us smooth things, prophesy visions or illusions. Let us hear no more about the Holy One of Israel. Yeah, in verse 11. Well, that's God. And he's their deliverance. And so here he is trying to help them, and they're saying, we want none of it. Be quiet and get out of the way. And now you begin to understand, when we introduced Isaiah, the Old Testament record does not tell us this, but there is a very, very strong tradition outside of Old Testament literature among the Jews that Isaiah was martyred, that he was put to death. And now you understand why. They didn't want to hear what he had to say. And he kept saying,
hey, which one of your prophets have your fathers not killed?
Right, and this is your backstory to these things that Jesus says to the people of Jerusalem in particular and to the Jews of his day in general, and that is, you're treating me like you've treated the prophets. In several of Jesus' parables, you see the prophets pop up in a parable, like the one about the vineyard that the owner planted, and then he sent servants to go collect. And they kept killing, stoning the servants and mistreating them and turning them back. And finally he sends his son and they kill his son. Well, that's prophets and Jesus. So, sometimes people say, I don't want to spend a lot of time in the Old Testament because the New Testament is so important. If you really want to understand the New Testament, get your nose in the Old Testament. It opens all kinds of doors and windows in the New Testament. And there it is. It's all the revelation of God.
And our prayer for you, Philip, is that you will not ever be tempted to speak pleasant words to us. And the thing is I know, not you, and I'm not saying that you would never be tempted by this, but no, every preacher comes under a certain type of pressure to speak pleasant words that are non-controversial. And I know of preachers who are told there are topics that we don't want you to cover in here. So taking from this, never speak to us pleasant words.
Thank you.
Speak to what the Bible tells you to tell us.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And all the men that get up and speak here need to take heed to that too. All of us. It's not what I want to say. It's not what you want to say. It's not what other people want us to say. It's what God says. And I'll just inject this. It's really easy when you get up and you present a message to the church to want to talk about something you really want to talk about. Maybe there's a place for that, but there's also a danger in that. What is God saying? What are we finding in here? That's what we want to talk about. Because that's where the guidance is. Yeah.
This last phrase that was read in verse 11 calls the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. We're living in a culture now that is very applicable, because in the culture we're living in, it's not, people don't want you to talk about God. You can talk about politics, you can talk about the weather, you can talk about anything, but as soon as you start to talk about God, and I've experienced this a lot, the subject has changed among my own relatives even, you know. They don't want to talk about God, and nothing ever changes. It's still the same.
Yeah. Again, the human tendencies that we're seeing in this chapter, they haven't gone away, have they? The temptations to want to handle these things this way. Well, look at verse 12 to 14. 12 to 14. Daryl, can you read those verses, 12 to 14?
Therefore, thus says the Holy One of Israel, since you have rejected this word and have put your trust in oppression and guile and have relied on them, therefore this iniquity will be to you like a breach about to fall, a bulge in a high wall, whose collapse comes suddenly in an instant, and whose collapse is like the smashing of a potter's jar, so ruthlessly shattered that a sherd will not be found among its pieces to take fire from a hearth or to scoop water from a cistern.
All right, thank you. He says here, since you have ignored the word of the Lord and you trust in what is perverse and oppression and so forth, here are the consequences. So he depicts with analogies here, word pictures, two consequences. Now, several weeks ago, and when we did Isaiah and we sampled Isaiah on a Wednesday night, Ray Coney's activity in the conference room was right with these two verses right here, verse 13 and 14. And he talked to you about that. Well, what are the two analogies? In verse 13, he's saying that because you've rejected the Lord's guidance and leaned on other guidance, what's going to happen in verse 13? It's going to be like what? It's like a wall breaking or a dam breaking. It's going to fall on top of you. And what's the picture in verse 14? What's going to happen to them? They're going to be shattered or broken to the point, it's like you take a vessel, a potter's vessel, and you break it until what? There's nothing left, not even a shard to scoop up some, you know, ash or fire, you know, from a fire or even some water. Ancient people were huge recyclers. And I'm not talking about aluminum cans. But any kind of garment, any kind of pottery, even if a pottery was broken, they would still try to find a way to use it. And so this is a piece of pottery that is so shattered, it's useless. Not even a shard left to scrape things with. And so this is going to depict, you know, their end, because they don't respect and listen to the Lord. Okay, we're going to hit some highlights here in the rest of this chapter in verses 18 to 33. But, you know, just as soon as you start feeling the heat and the barb of these prophetic messages, all of a sudden there's this hug. There's this tender, wonderful, joyful message that is paired with it. That's about the possibility of renewal and restoration. Well, look at verse 18 to 23. Andrew, can you read 18 to 23 for us, please?
Therefore, the Lord will wait that he may be gracious to you. Therefore, he will be exalted that he may have mercy on you. For the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all those who wait for him. For the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. You shall weep no more. He will be very gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. How far?
23.
And though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity, the water of affliction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore. But your eyes shall see your teachers. Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. Whenever you turn to the right hand, or whenever you turn to the left, you will also defile the covering of your images of silver, and the ornament of your molded images of gold. You will throw them away as an unclean thing, and you will say to them, get away. Then he will give the rain for your seed, which you sow the ground, and the bread of the increase of the earth. It will be fat plentiful. In that day, your cattle will feed in large pastures.
All right, I want you to contrast, thank you, what we were just talking about in verse 13 and 14. Everything's going to collapse on top of them. They're going to be so shattered, there's nothing left. Look at the contrast. And just as sure as God's justice and how he's going to discipline Judah and Israel, his nature also is that of love and concern, compassion, and restoration. Look at verse 18. The Lord waits to be gracious to you. He exalts himself to show mercy. The concept that God is this heavenly deity that's just waiting to fling lightning bolts to char us at every second, it's a complete misunderstanding of the nature of God. God yearns. He wants to be gracious to us. And what's depicted in verse 19 to 23 is what is possible, and what's possible is not destruction, but restoration. What's possible is not suffering, but rather prosperity. Everything's productive, and plants are growing, and animals are thriving, and you know, livestock in large pastures, and all these kinds of things. Before, it's dire consequences. Now, restoration. Now, what's going to happen here? What is this about? Like so many things, there is a partial initial fulfillment of these things earlier, and then there is an ultimate fulfillment and a complete fulfillment later. So in Isaiah's day, Assyria is going to threaten Jerusalem and lay siege against it. And then the Assyrian threat will be repelled. More on that in a moment. And they'll be delivered. Really, at a moment when all looks lost, Jerusalem's going to be saved. So this in part would reflect what's going to happen there with the deliverance from Assyrian threat. However, there's some things here about this that don't really historically line up with what happens in Jerusalem after the Assyrian threat. Not completely. For instance, look at verse 20 and 21. Now what is their relationship to God's messengers in verse 20 and 21? Remember before they're saying to God's messengers, shut up, we don't want to hear it. But in verse 20 and 21, what? The teacher, this is God's messenger, teach us. And you tell us what? Verse 21.
The right way in which you can walk.
Which way to walk? You tell us the way to walk. That's what God wants. And look at verse 22. What would they do to the thing that had been Israel and Judah's undoing?
Graven images.
They would get rid of idolatry. Now, Hezekiah will be a king that will carry out a revival and cleanse, to some extent, Judah of idolatry. Josiah will come along later and do the same, even to a greater degree. But Jerusalem never got rid of their idols completely, permanently. They kept coming back. And by the time you get to those latter kings like Manasseh, it's rampant. It's so bad at one point, the temple is shut down before Josiah. The temple is shut down. Josiah has to reopen it. So this really doesn't depict that, which means that there is an eventual, ultimate fulfillment in the Messiah, who's going to restore the true Israel and the true Jerusalem, which is God's people through Christ. And they're going to be the ones to say, God, teach us. They're going to be the ones that will make God their God and no idol their God. But speaking of that deliverance from Assyrian threat, look down at verse 30 to 33 at what's depicted there. Justin, can you read 30 to 33, please? Yeah, Jess.
And the Lord will cause his voice of authority to be heard, and the descending of his arm to be seen in fierce anger, and in the flame of a consuming fire, in cloudbursts, downpour, and hailstones. For at the voice of the Lord, Assyria will be terrified when he strikes with the rod, and every blow of the rod of punishment which the Lord will lay on him will be with the music of tambourines and lyres. And in battles, brandishing weapons, he will fight them. For Topheth has long been ready. Indeed, it has been prepared for the king. He has made it deep and large, a pyre of fire with plenty of wood. The breath of the Lord, like a torrent of brimstone, sets it afire.
All right, thank you. Look how Assyria is named here. What's going to happen to Assyria? Destroyed. Who's going to do it? God's going to strike them. God's going to fight against them. And note in verse 30 and in verse 31, when it comes to God striking Assyria, how does his attack begin? Verse 30 and 31. His voice. His voice. The Lord will call his majestic voice to be heard. Verse 31. The Syrians will be terrified, terror-stricken at the voice of the Lord. When he strikes with his rod. It's so interesting how that it's God speaking that is the impetus of his power. And that's the same with Genesis 1. That's the same with sending his son. That's the same with the power of the gospel. It's God speaking to us. Yeah, Joe.
Is he talking about twofold prophecy here? I mean, the destruction of Sennacherib's army and then the fall of Nineveh? How would you take that?
I think initially this is going to be the turning back of the siege of Jerusalem. They're going to be struck by God. But that will be, that will create a domino effect. And that is Assyria will not penetrate down into this Canaan or what we know later on as Palestine area like they have been. And they will eventually start to get weaker and weaker until the Babylonians overrun them. It's a huge blow. It is. You see that in a few weeks. Yeah. Yeah. And we'll say something about that in just a second. But look at verse 33. What's going to happen to the king of Assyria? And this might be part of the answer to your question, Joe, because this is what's going to be true for the king of Assyria pretty soon after they're turned back from Jerusalem. He's going to be assassinated. And how is it depicted in verse 33? What's made ready for the king?
Fire pit.
Fire. What kind of fire?
Funeral.
A funeral pyre. Okay. Do people not watch Star Wars? No, and Darth Vader. Okay. So, in ancient times, a lot of ancient societies, and even some not so ancient, the funeral pyre is so vivid kind of thing. So you take the body and you burn it openly. Now, we have cremation today, but it's a very clinical, sterile kind of thing, out of sight. But this is like public. You burn the body. And so God's preparing a funeral pyre for the king of Assyria. So, that's what God can do. And then look at chapter 31. Let's hit 31 real quickly here. Let's look at verses 1 to 3. Zachary, can you read verse 1 to 3 of chapter 31, please?
Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But do not look to the Holy One of Israel or consult the Lord. And yet he is wise and brings disaster. He does not call back his words, but will arise against the house of the evildoers and against the helpers of those who work iniquity. The Egyptians are man and not God, and their horses are flesh and not spirit. When the Lord stretches out his hand, the helper will stumble, and he who is helped will fall, and they will all perish together.
All right, thank you. Isaiah has to keep preaching. Don't rely on Egypt. He's preaching the same sermon. And that shows you how much they need it. In verses 1 to 3, what is faulty about their reasoning regarding how they can be protected and helped? What's faulty about their leaning on Egypt? They're men. And I think such a powerful statement in verse 3, their horses are flesh and not spirit. If only we could learn that the real power in the universe is spiritual, not fleshly. It's spiritual. That's where the real power is. And, you know, it's horses and chariots or the Lord. It's man or God. It's horses with flesh or the spirit, okay? And I want you to look down at verse 4 and 5. Just glance at it. The Lord is described now as being a protector of Jerusalem. In what way? The Lord is compared to being a lion. So here's a lion, and he is threatening. And who's trying to stop him? A band of what? Shepherds. And what are the shepherds doing to try to stop the lion? Shouting at him. Oh yeah, good luck with that. Now I know there's some big wild beasts that if you get real big, stand up on a table or a car, or you shout, or you bang pots and pans, they'll go away. I know that some bears are like that, okay? But the point here in this context is, lions aren't. You don't go out to a lion that's about to attack and say, no, no, buddy, you can't do that around here. Get out, get, go. You do that to an old cat or something or an old dog in the neighborhood. Get out of here, okay, like that. You can't do that to a lion. No way. And there's another animal God's compared to in verse 5. God is like what regarding Jerusalem?
Birds.
Birds that are just hovering and protecting. He's hovering over Jerusalem. Wow, what great imagery. And then look at verse 6 to 9. Zachary, read that for us, please.
Turn to him from whom people have deeply revolted, O children of Israel. For in that day everyone shall cast away his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which your hands have sinfully made for you. And the Assyrian shall fall by a sword, not of man, and a sword, not of man, shall devour him. And he shall flee from the sword, and his young men shall be put to forced labor. His rock shall pass away in terror, and his officers desert the standard in panic, declares the Lord, whose fire is in Zion, and whose furnace is in Jerusalem.
Thank you. It's hard to line up exactly what we're doing in class with the congregational reading, but boy, this lines up quite in a dandy fashion. Beginning tomorrow and through this week, you're going to get into the narrative, the historical section of Isaiah, that actually in historical form, and Les is going to teach a class on this in a few weeks when I'm away preaching in Indiana. This class will get to 36 in a few weeks. But what happens in 36, 37, and 38 is the account of the Assyrian army laying siege to Jerusalem and basically telling Hezekiah in Jerusalem, give up. Everybody's folded in front of us. We're going to fold you too. Just go ahead and give up. And Hezekiah does not. And you'll read about what happens to the Assyrian army, things that we've been referencing over and over, including today. In these verses right here, Isaiah 31, 6 through 9, put those in your back pocket and pull it out tomorrow when you start reading 36, 37, and 38. Because according to verse 8, how will the Assyrians be turned back and defeated? According to verse 8, not how. Not by sword, not with man, not in a physical way, not in the typical military way. God's going to do it His way. And that's what you'll read about in the coming week. So, all right. Thank you very much.